New Jersey Governor Chris Christie vetoes a measure increasing the state's minimum wage. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The bill proposed to raise the rate to $10.10 an hour in the next year and to at least $15 an hour over the next 5 years. Christie says raising wages that much would make doing business in the state unaffordable.
While the bill's proposed increase surely is responsive to the demands of Democratic legislators' political patrons, it fails to consider the capacity of businesses, especially small businesses, to absorb the substantially increased labor costs it will impose.
Michael Rothwell is one of the owners of the Pennington Central Market. That's where Christie issued his veto. Rothwell says it would be hard for small businesses with a slim profit margin to absorb higher labor costs.
If we are forced to reduce staff and customer service levels drop and we have to raise prices, it could also potentially threaten our ability to remain in business.
Democratic leaders say they'll pursue a constitutional amendment to raise New Jersey's minimum wage. A federal appeals court delivers a blow to 28 immigrant mothers and their children who are being detained in Berks County, around 70 miles north of Philadelphia. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, the judge found that because the mothers from Latin America entered the United States illegally, they do not have a right to their day in court.
The mothers and their kids from El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala say they were escaping things like gang wars and domestic violence when they crossed the border into Texas. They were immediately arrested and screened to see if they were fleeing a real threat. The government said they weren't, so they are transferred to Pennsylvania and sit detained in limbo. Now a federal appeals court has ruled that since they entered illegally, they need to be sent back to their home countries.
By definition, asylum seekers can't wait around in their countries looking for their papers and waiting until a visa comes through.
Lee Gallant is an attorney with the ACLU representing the detained families.
They have to flee immediately. Any parent would do that on behalf of their child if they faced the type of horrific abuse and possible death that these women and children were facing.
The issue that made its way all the way to the Third Circuit of Appeals is very narrow. It's not focused on whether they should be given asylum, but on a deeper legal question. If someone crosses the border illegally, do they have constitutional rights? It's been debated for decades in various cases. Here, though, the court said no, they don't. Some prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, have been given court hearings, the judges noted. That annoyed Attorney Gallant.
It's perverse to suggest that those enemy combatants are entitled to habeas corpus, but not these women and children who are on U.S. soil.
Gallant says the deportations are on hold pending their appeal. A spokesman for the Department of Justice declined an interview request. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
The Lower Merion School District in Montgomery County is known for its students' high test scores and its homeowners' high property values. But it's the district's fiscal hijinks that are grabbing headlines, as WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arendt reports.
A Montgomery County judge finds that Lower Merion officials repeatedly fudge their annual budget in order to justify tax increases and circumvent state law. This unusual case started when a lawyer, Arthur Wolk, noticed his tax bill climbing.
So I said, this strikes me as something that really needs a hard look.
Wolk discovered a pattern. Lower Merion would project a deficit every year, but end with a surplus. State law prohibits school districts from raising taxes more than 2.4% unless they can prove that special education or pension costs threaten to put them in the red. Wolk argued in court that the district was misrepresenting its finances in order to convince the state that it needed more money. And on Monday, a common pleas judge agreed.
The school district is involved in basically a theft of the taxpayer property. I mean, they just think it's something they can just take as much as they want from the taxpayer, and they can't. They're going to have to follow the law, and I'm going to be the person who makes sure they do.
The judge ordered Lower Merion to rescind a 4.44% tax hike it had already implemented for the current fiscal year. He didn't say whether the district would have to refund taxpayers for past increases. Since 2006, property taxes in the district have climbed 53%, according to court records. District officials say they plan to appeal the decision and that the end-of-year balances were the result of good money management, not deceit. Multiple experts approached for this story say they knew of no other cases where a Pennsylvania taxpayer successfully challenged a school district hike. Districts have leaned more heavily on local taxpayers in recent years as the state has reduced education funding. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
Over the next decade, the Philadelphia Housing Authority wants to completely rebuild a small, struggling section of North Philly. Some of the work will eventually unfold along Cecil B. Moore Avenue, once one of the city's busiest hubs for live music, especially jazz and R&B. WHYY's Aaron Moselle dug into that history and offers this report.
Sharswood is an arrowhead-shaped neighborhood north of Girard Avenue between 19th and 27th Streets. And if you've walked around there recently, you've probably heard a fair amount of this. Since early spring, the Philadelphia Housing Authority has been busy building new rental units as part of a planned half-billion-dollar transformation project. On some blocks, it's like watching missing piano keys being added back to the row, all at once. But in the 1940s and 50s, the neighborhood was home to factory workers, and this was its soundtrack, especially as you traveled down Cecil B. Moore Avenue towards Broad Street. Back then, it was known as Columbia Avenue, and about a dozen or so clubs dotted it. You could hear twists on old standards, songs you could move to, then go to another spot next door or up the block and listen in on a jam session showcasing the newest evolution of jazz, bebop. Now is the time the tune you're hearing now was particularly popular and a favorite of saxophone giant Charlie Parker, who played Columbia Avenue in his younger years. Trumpet legend Dizzy Gillespie made appearances too. Lovett Hines is artistic director of the Philadelphia Clef Club of Jazz and Performing Arts. He says Columbia Avenue was also a proving grounds of sorts for up-and-coming musicians.
It was those finishing schools. You did your work at home, but you had to come and take your exams at those clubs.
For patrons, Columbia Avenue was a place to be seen. People wore their best.
Guys wouldn't even sit down because they didn't want to break the crease in their pants.
Piano player Cullen Knight started gigging on the Avenue when he was just 17, even though the law said you had to be 21.
The key to it was my dad had purchased me a new piano, so I had a piano. And I had a connection with the piano companies, the movers, to move the piano into the club. See, so I had the job because when I left, the piano left with me.
Knight also says you had to be a card-carrying member of the American Federation of Musicians, a union.
Clubs had a scale. You had A, B, C, D. A club maybe paid $15 a night or something like that, you know, for a side man. You could rent a house for like $25 a month or something like that.
How do you speak to an angel? I'm completely in the dark.
Don Gardner played Columbia Avenue at night and worked the breakfast shift as a short order cook before high school. Gardner was a drummer at first before switching to become a singer. He says the musicians on Columbia were like one big family. They respected one another and shared advice, even about women. During a recent stroll up the avenue, Gardner recalled legendary vocalist Sarah Vaughan giving him her opinion.
When she'd see me talking to certain girls, she'd say, "That ain't for you. She's not for you." "Why?" "She's not for you, Don." You know. So I would leave it alone. And sure enough, she was right. She wasn't for me. You know, because she was messing with dope or something else, and that wasn't my thing.
Gardner left Philly in the early 60s. He lived and played in New York for a while, even Europe, before returning to the city. He visits every now and then, but there's not really much reason to anymore. The old clubs on Columbia Avenue are gone. Mickey's Playhouse is now a takeout Chinese restaurant. What happened? Lovett Hines with the Clef Club says, for one, musical tastes changed. By the late 50s, jazz was no longer pop music. To the younger generation, it was grandpa music.
The 21s and 22s and 23s are now going to, you know, the rhythm and blues and rock and rolls and the Motowns and Stax Records.
Those labels were known for soul artists. Hines says desegregation also meant African Americans could now play all over the city. He says an infamous riot along Columbia Avenue in 1964 was the nail in the coffin.
Despite the efforts of more than 1,500 law enforcement officers, efforts to quell rioting and looting in North Philadelphia have not been successful.
In late August that year, rumors of a white police officer beating a black pregnant woman swirled across North Philadelphia. Tensions had already been bubbling for months, with the allegations, they boiled over. Over 3 days, dozens of white-owned stores along Columbia Avenue were looted and set on fire. The area never really recovered. The Philadelphia Housing Authority wants to write a new chapter in that history, effectively building a mixed-income community from scratch. The agency is still in the process of gathering all the funds needed to make that a reality. But if everything goes according to plan, officials think the neighborhood will sing like it hasn't in decades. I'm Aaron Moselle, WHYY News.
Still ahead, obsolete technology finds a new life at the hands of a local musician.
It's like music inspired by or even directly created with the onboard sound capabilities of old video game systems.
We'll check out chiptunes as Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Running an airline isn't easy, especially when the lights go out, literally.
Fortunately, we were able to get the equipment back up relatively quickly, within a couple of hours. But at that point, the damage was done because the ripple effect of all the cancellations on one of the busiest travel days.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Delta Airlines, in a conversation from the corner office next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace follows Newsworks Tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
Virginia Mason Institute supports WHYY. From September 26th to 28th, in the heart of Philadelphia, Virginia Mason Institute is hosting a workshop for healthcare leaders who want to measurably improve workflow and patient access. Led by Dr. Henry Otero and Chris Backus, the workshop Creating Flow in the Ambulatory Setting is designed to enable participants to increase quality, safety, and efficiency, and sustain the outcomes for their patients and staff. More information and registration details are available at virginiamasoninstitute.org.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. The candidates for a hotly contested congressional race in Bucks County met today in the first general election debate of a campaign that will draw national attention. WHYY's Dave Davies was at the studio of radio station WBCB in Levittown for the face-off.
The 8th District offers a rare thing in congressional contests, a seat that's both open and competitive. Incumbent Republican Mike Fitzpatrick is not seeking re-election in a district covering all of Bucks County and a sliver of Montgomery County. Voters here have chosen both Democrats and Republicans in recent years. The Democrat in the race is four-term State Representative Steve Santaciro, who touts a record of working with local Republicans. His opponent is Brian Fitzpatrick, the brother of the incumbent. He grew up in Bucks County but pursued a career in the FBI and lived outside the district until late last year, when he surprised other Republican hopefuls by moving back and capturing the party's nomination. Santaciro raised the issue of Fitzpatrick's background early in the debate.
And the fact of the matter is, you would not be running for Congress today if you didn't have connections. Your brother is the congressman. You came in from California just 8 months ago and were handed the Republican nomination. I think that's the definition of an insider.
Fitzpatrick was ready for the attack and came back at Santaciro.
Only a career politician would call an FBI agent who spent their career arresting politicians an insider. You've got to be kidding me, Steve. And this is going to be a theme that recurs over and over and over again, is what I believe to be the polluted mindset of people that have been in politics far too long that are more concerned with partisanship than they are about fixing problems.
There was some substantive policy debate. Both said they favored federal action to bring student loan interest rates close to zero and force colleges to control tuition hikes. Both criticized the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal as unfair to American workers. Asked about Obamacare, Santaciro, the Democrat, said he favors a government health care option to compete with private plans. Fitzpatrick distinguished himself from many Republicans by saying he'd like to reform, not repeal, Obamacare, saying he favors market-based solutions. Things got heated when the candidates were asked about their party's presidential nominees. Santaciro said he supports Hillary Clinton, who he said served in the Senate and earned bipartisan praise as Secretary of State.
And on the other side, we have someone who didn't even know that the Russians had taken Crimea, someone who has challenged whether or not has questioned whether or not we should be supporting our NATO allies, someone who has threatened to ban an entire group of people from entering the country based on their religion.
Fitzpatrick responded.
I fully acknowledge all of the problems that Donald Trump has, and there are plenty. But that demonstrates my independence. What Steve fails to do, cannot bring himself to criticize Hillary Clinton. Be honest, Steve. For once in your life, be independent. Strip yourself from your partisanship. Serve your country.
Throughout the exchange, Fitzpatrick never said whether he supported Trump, and when asked afterward, he said little and kept a brisk pace towards a waiting SUV.
You okay. Won't say whether you're supporting Mr. Trump, is that right?
I've made it clear in my previous press.
In a July press release, Fitzpatrick did say he'd support his party's nominee. So far, one more debate is scheduled for October. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
The streets of First Friday, Philadelphia will come alive with the sound of chiptunes. Rather than traditional instruments, these are sounds generated by, think, video game consoles and vintage computers. Let's learn more with Lisa Carr, a doctoral candidate at Duke University and the aptly named Chipocrite, a.k.a. Paul Weinstein. Paul, Lisa, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight. Paul, I have to go right to the source with a moniker, Chipocrite.
Yes.
Tell us about this genre.
Basically, the way I describe chiptune is like, I kind of have this go-to definition. It's like music inspired by or even directly created with the onboard sound capabilities of old video game systems or old computers. Anything that basically had like a sound chip in it, didn't play back recorded digital audio the way you would listen to like an MP3 or a wave or something. It had basically a little synthesizer inside it, and it wasn't really meant to be an instrument. It was meant to be a game or a toy or a computer or something, but incidentally it made music.
Let's hear an example. Paul, this isn't a new phenomena, a new genre of music. Apparently there was a group, Yellow Magic Orchestra, that was in a sense plying this trade way back in the late 70s.
Pretty much, yeah. They're not like always pointed to as the first video game inspired, like, you know, quote unquote mainstream electronic musician, but they, on their earliest albums, they basically were using sounds from arcade machines and things like that, and just kind of like casually putting it in there with the rest of their electronic music as if it was a normal thing to do. And it was just not a normal thing to do at the time. But now, you know, people take old computers and stuff and incorporate them into their music as a main instrument. And that's basically what I do.
And I understand perhaps the most renowned of these groups is one entitled Anamanaguchi.
That's right. They are a New York-based band. They've been doing this since like the early 2000s. They've gotten pretty good recognition for this. They've had their music in like Target ads.
Let's try to get a better sense of its place now, what it draws from the past, and where it might go in the future by bringing Lisa Clar into the mix. You're a doctoral candidate in literature, and I understand your dissertation is entitled Useless, The Aesthetics of Obsolescence in 20th Century U.S. Culture. So let's bring chiptunes into that fold.
Sure.
Explain your interest.
Well, I have, growing up in Detroit, kind of outside of Detroit in the 1980s and the 1990s, I was kind of first exposed to the ways in which artists use obsolete objects for various ends. And at that time, artists were using kind of the obsolete spaces, obsolete kind of people within the city to draw attention to Detroit's kind of social and economic crises. And so obsolescence for me has always been kind of a burden, kind of a haunting, something that kind of one generation kind of leaves to the next.
Is it in part because technology is evolving so quickly now compared to past decades that this is a interesting study?
Right. Here our change happens, right? Like, I mean, now with the iPhone every year or two. So it has increased exponentially. And I think that's one of the main reasons why kind of chiptune artists are drawn specifically to kind of these outdated technologies. Specifically, the Game Boy is kind of the technology of choice for most chiptune artists. And I've heard it said, right, that the Game Boy has something like a fraction of the computing power of today's iPhone. You know, we have all of these like sophisticated technologies that you could use in the studio to make really kind of hyper-technological kind of sounds. And instead, chiptunes tends to position itself against that kind of corporate music culture and kind of try to return to these kind of simpler technological objects.
Game Boy, and I'm interviewing Chipocrit, Paul Weinstein. Paul, is this inordinately a male-driven genre?
Yeah, I would say kind of, unfortunately, it is probably more male-driven. I think all of us wish there were more females involved, but there are several. Actually, at both nights of this festival that I was just at, each night the main headliner was a female. On the first night, it was Chip Zoll, and she is amazing. I've seen her a couple times. She's been brought over to the United States. This is like the third time this year that she's been brought over by someone who really wanted her at their event. And then the second night was basically just kind of a straight-ahead DJ producer named Ducky, but she was like she did more of a traditional DJ set with, you know, DJ decks and a mixer, and she was one of the most masterful DJs I've ever seen. And I was just like, this is awesome. This is like motivational for women. I hope like this, there should be more stuff like this for sure.
Paul Weinstein records under the name Chipocrit. We also spoke with PhD candidate Lisa Klar. They'll be presenting Chiptunes, Obsolete Sounds in the Modern World, Friday evening at the Chemical Heritage Foundation, and you can hear much more of our conversation, as well as other examples of chiptunes at newsworks.org. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Check us out on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.